Hello, everybody. I'm an alcoholic. My name's Keith. By God's grace, Alcoholics Anonymous, room full of people like you, and a little bit of effort on my own, I've not had to take a drink of alcohol or use any kind of narcotic since May 11, 1976, and for that I'm especially grateful. I want to thank the committee. Al did a great job, and certainly is being replaced by someone of beauty. Great. That's a compliment. Yeah. After his short stint here, this is the last time you'll ever see me. Good. We'll be glad to see you. What a refresher. Yeah. There you go. Bring out the old and bring in the new, baby. You betcha. I want to thank the committee for inviting me to participate in my own recovery. It's always a good feeling to be able to participate in my own recovery. I got a few people I'd like to recognize. My home group's back there. They've been moving them from that side of the room to that side of the room, but there's three or four tables back there, way back there. So. Speakers talk about working the steps and doing all the stuff and everything else, and I know there's Al-Anons in here and you don't believe anything we say. So there's 35 guys back there that, come from my home group, but I came here to be sure that I stick to the message. And on the other end of the deal, my sponsor's here, Chino John. Will you stand up? Stand up, John. Come on. 48 years sober. So I feel especially blessed to be able to have that bunch behind me and that guy there in front of me. And he lights up my life, and he makes me laugh. And I'm glad that they're there. It's awful hard for me to deviate whenever I have that kind of deal going. We were coming out here, and I looked at the lineup of speakers, and I know all the speakers and been with them, and I've heard their stories and everything else. And I was riding along in the truck with some young alcoholics, and they were listening to some rap music. And I said, maybe it'd be cool if we could, get a karaoke thing, and I could, take the voice out of this rap song, and then I could say my story, and then I could get up here and I just punch a button and rap my story, My wife said, "Isn't your sponsor going to be there?" I said, "Yeah." Because then I just stick to what you do and what they ask you to do, and that's the deal. But Scott and Linda, I feel for you, baby. You got Willie Nelson and the crew ahead of you are competing with you with your relationship meeting and then something else, karaoke and the dance. And if that goes bad, Scott and Linda will be having a meeting on relationships, right? Before the dancing or Lily or what after, all through it. And legal help too will be there in case you want to get in something or get out of something. I don't know. Well, we cover it all, don't we? Alcoholics talking ideals and living reality, and I love it. I love it. I love to be sober, and I'm grateful, that I'm sober today. When I'm in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, the world is a safer place, and I assume it is because you're here too. I don't know anything but what it used to be like, what happened, what it's like today in a general way, and thank God it's in a general way. Experience, strength, and hope, and that's all I know. I've never had anything but Alcoholics Anonymous in over 29 years, never used anything but Alcoholics Anonymous, never needed anything but Alcoholics Anonymous. And Alcoholics Anonymous has been the one thing that has allowed me to stay sober. Strong sponsorship. I'm a product of strong sponsorship. Come from a home group. My home group's 44 years old. I didn't start it. I'm just a member of it in good standing. I'm a product of Alcoholics Anonymous. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had a wife and a kid and a dog and a cat, and it wasn't my first time to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. My story is not that I came to a meeting and stayed sober from then on. I'd been in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous for approximately 6 years prior to finally sobering up. So I'm living proof that you can go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and drink and not sober up and just take care of the conditions and not change anything, and I stayed drunk for 6 years going in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know if I was born an alcoholic or not, but when I took my first drink, an alcoholic was born, and that was at an early age because I grew up in an alcoholic home, which is not any prerequisite necessarily. It's just simply the fact that if you're a budding alcoholic and you grow up in an alcoholic home, there's alcohol around there and you have a lot of opportunities to drink. It's the solution for everything. My dad was an alcoholic, his dad was an alcoholic, his dad was an alcoholic, and his dad was an alcoholic, and that's as far back as I wanted to check. And the only thing that I mention that for is that as generation upon generation upon generation trickled down, all the character defects did too. And by the time it got to me, I was our family's best worst example. And I had all the character defects of all the other alcoholics just rolled into one. The only person that came to Alcoholics Anonymous other than myself was my father. He was a lawyer. He was too smart to be an alcoholic. I really didn't want him to sober up until I did, and then because I needed a drunken lawyer. I kept him on retainer for years, you know. And then I sobered up 14 months before he did, and he was 62 years old. He sobered up, went to Alcoholics Anonymous, sobered up, and never drank again. And he just died this last November, 89 years old. And so I had 14 months of seniority on him, and I never let him forget it. And but we were able to make our amends, and it took time and what have you, and it worked out, and we were in good standing. We had family recovery. My father died sober, and we had a good relationship. And I'm grateful for that. Alcoholics Anonymous put a family back together. I went to AA, my wife went to Al-Anon, my kid went to Alateen, my dog went to Alley Dog, and my cat went to Alley Cat. And they all released me, and I found myself in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I just hung on. I started drinking at an early age, and I liked it. I didn't analyze it. It worked, and it was handy, and I drank, and I immediately started getting in trouble. I grew up in a farming community in the Texas Panhandle, and I had a driver's license when I was 12 years old because I had a farm permit, and I could drive, and I had a car, and when I was 12 and a half years old, I got busted for drinking and driving and leaving the scene of an accident. And as a result of that, they locked me up for the next 3 or 4 years. And it wasn't any big penitentiary or any big thing. It wasn't a prep school either. I'll tell you, it was prepping me for something, but I didn't realize it at the time. But I was locked up with a bunch of boys, and they had barbed wire around it. We couldn't escape. And I was at school there and sports and what have you, and I functioned. I learned a lot of other things in there, how to survive and whatnot. And then I got out of there and went back home and got married and got abandoned. I started my abandonment issues way back in there somewhere. I didn't realize that's what they were, but people were leaving my life all the time. And that today I know they were abandonment issues, but they just said, I'm out of here, you know. And ultimately my grandmother was a wise lady, and she said it doesn't take any more effort to marry a rich woman than it does a poor woman. And I didn't realize, though, that it takes more effort to keep a rich woman than a poor one sometimes, but I didn't hear that part of it. And I married this young lady who was sweet and innocent, and her father had a lot of money, and he was helping us out, and whatever, you know, alcoholic, I never had enough, and it was never enough, and I was enhancing my income by driving some stolen cars. I borrowed them, and I was, you know, transporting some non-habit-forming outside issues. No big deal. I wasn't a big crook. I just stole a car, and it had some burlap bags in the back, which it had some residue in them, and I had a hit and run with bodily injury and leaving the scene of the accident again. It seemed like that happened to me. And I got caught down in Fort Worth, Texas, and the result of that, they locked me up, and my father-in-law came to see me, and he said, I have a lot of money, and I said, I noticed that, and he said, well, the reason I have a lot of money is because I don't make bad investments, and you're a bad investment. And as a result of that, I had to do some time down in Huntsville, and I did my time. They didn't have all these new things they have nowadays, like anger management and, you know, control your medication and all that stuff. You just did your time, back against the wall, do it, get out. I got out, they got $100 and a new suit, and I got a train down in Texas and got a ticket, train headed for Amarillo, Texas, and I kind of got a jug of whiskey and did my first 4-step. I look back on my life and I recognize that I need to stay out of these honky tonks. I can't hang around these honky tonks. I need to stay away from these sick, sick women, banging like 10 of them up against the wall, and I get the sickest one every time. Some in here tonight You feel them. They're, boy, they're packed in here close together. There's kind of a hum. I just, it makes the, don't you just love it? Don't you love it, man? I mean, they're ready. They don't need to pack. They're ready. Let's go. Hurry up. Shut up there so we can go out here and try something new. Well, I got to Amarillo, Texas, and my two very best friends, Oily and Goose, were waiting there, no pickup. And they've been drinking moonshine and 3-2 beer, and I crawled out of that train, and I got in the old pickup truck with them, and I did my first fifth step, and I told Oily and Goose, I need to stay out of them honky-tonks, and I need to stay from them women, and I got to stay out of places with guys like you, and they agreed with everything. You know, we're drinking, and we got off down in the country out there at Wolf Creek where the men and the sheep run scared. I mean, that's where they have them dances, you know, where there's no police, there's nothing. Got in there at midnight and started to fight, and the fight got out of hand, and I ducked into the woman's restroom, and there was a lady standing next to the door, and I said, tell me when the fight's over. And I went in and ducked in the stall and waited, and pretty soon she stuck her head in and said, you can come out now, cowboy. The band was playing, and she was handy, and I'm a quick study. And I asked her for a dance, and one quick dance, I found out she had a job, a car, driver's license, money in the bank, place to stay, none of which did I have, so I fell in love. And she said, where you been? I haven't seen you around. And I said, well, where you been? I haven't seen you around. And she said, well, I just got out of an unwed mother's home. And I said, well, I just got out of the penitentiary. We deserve each other. Let's give two other people a break, you know. And so we did, you know. We fell in love with you. That's where the rocks in my head fit the holes in hers. You know, I mean, it was just... I found out later that she finished the fight that I started, see? And, oh, we dated for 2 weeks, and they nicknamed us Hatchet and Hammer. I'm telling you, man, it was love. It had to be love. It was just too painful to be anything else. Funny thing, that was 45 years ago, baby, and we're still in there rocking tonight. Yeah. Yeah. You betcha. That isn't because I wanted to stay married all that time. It's because she didn't believe in divorce. Murder, but not divorce. And I'm telling you, it was just you know, one of those things where, you know, after 2 years of hanging around there, why, she gave me the ultimatum. She said, I'm pregnant. I said, I don't remember that. I must have been crossing over the invisible line when that happened. I mean, and, oh, you're the father. And I said, okay. So we got married, and I didn't know. I had no clue how to be a husband or a father or anything. I didn't even know what responsibility was until I was sober a while. And it was responsibility is the ability to respond. Anyway, we, you know, she was pregnant, sure enough, and had a little girl, and I had to do something like get a job and do something like that. And I tried to occupy my time with things that were easy to do. I went to school and somebody asked my dad, so where's Junior now? Well, he's in college. So, well, what's he majoring in? He said, I think it's electronics so he can learn how to wire home for money. You know? It was just wild and crazy and I loved it. And after a period of time, well, I was getting in a little trouble, and we decided to do a geographic. So my very best friend, a guy named Lion Shorty, told me that I could get a job on a ranch 40 miles west of Long Beach. Oh, ye of little faith. Now, a guy named Lion Shorty wouldn't lie to you, would he? So we loaded up in our car. We threw everything in the car, you know, the dog and the cat and the kid and this old station wagon, put the seats down, piled all our stuff in the back, loaded the trailer up, left in the middle of the night. Went through Oklahoma City to get something to help me get to California, because the guy says it's going to take a while. It did. It took me 30 days to go from Oklahoma City to Los Angeles. Most people can do it in 3, but I was lost a lot. You know? Everybody was crazy the time we got there, and I knocked the mirror off the right side of the car, and she was leaning out the window to check if I could change lanes, and we got busted just as soon as I got to California. The highway patrol said, we don't have human rearview mirrors in California. The only way I could shut her up, you know, I mean, hang out the window. It was just crazy. The dog would stand up behind my back of my head and drill all over the back, and then a big truck would go by and chase the truck all the way to the back of the station wagon and hit his head on the back window and fall on the cat. And they'd have a dog and cat fight on top of the kid, and the kid would be bawling, and she'd be bitching, and I'd be drinking, and we did that one day at a time for 30 days. Yeah, baby. They say, when we got here, one day at a time. I know that deal. I lived like there was no tomorrow. What's the difference? I found a drunken uncle. He got me a deal on a house, moved in this house, got a sweet deal on this house. Nobody had lived in it for a couple of 3 years. It's kind of tore up, but it was a good deal. And I moved my family in there. Next door, a bunch of hippies and a motorcycle gang on the other side, you know. And I took up a little residency and went over next door to check out with the hippies, you know. They were dropping acid and laying around the front yard naked watching the sun come up and go down, you know. They give me a hit, and I went to see 2001. You know, I can join right in. I'm not a specialist. I'm a pig, you know. The only thing I've never had in my career of drinking and using was a pap smear. What I got to look for it if I go back. But I did drink with people who would have given you one. I suspect if I'd have blacked out with Wayne, I might have got a pap smear. I don't know. I'm not going to ask him if he gave me one. It was just crazy. I didn't know what was going to happen. I never realized what was going on. I just was doing the deal. I never stopped to figure it out or wonder what I got. I can remember looking back on my life and I'd get in trouble. It's $50, and then it's $100, and then it's $200, and then I wrecked every car I borrowed. And I'm one of them kind of guys that brings all these people home with them. You know, they're the guys that don't want to go home and fight with their wives, so they come over and watch me fight with my wife. Started carrying this butcher knife, so she's waving this butcher knife around all the time. I like guns myself. Guns will enhance conversation. I could pop a cap with a .44 mag right beside your ear, and you would pay attention to me. You wouldn't hear anything, but you'd pay attention to me. And I'd stick that gun right on the end of her nose, and she'd stick that knife right in my stomach, and she'd say, "You go first." I said, "You're crazy. If I shoot you, you'll die." She said, "I know. When the bullet hits me, it'll knock me back, and the knife will go forward, and you'll die too." You know, crazy women don't need to train for that. They don't. I'll tell you guys, there's no boot camp for that. They intuitively know that. I'd bring guys home, you know, and I'd be standing up there. She'd be waving the knife around. Them guys in the back of the line say, "Get her, get her. Step to the head of the line, eh? She's got a butcher knife up here, huh?" I got in one time and passed out on her 15 minutes into a two-hour conversation, so she stabbed me all over my back. When I came to, my old shirt was stuck to my back. And "What's wrong with my back?" She said, "Oh, let me see." She said, "Oh, you've been drinking that rock gut whiskey and you've broken out of acne in the back." He said, "Let me get the rubbing alcohol and I'll..." Well, oh, yeah. That got me closer to Jesus than anything the Baptist did. We were going to get baptized all the time, you know, and my daughter came up to me one time and showed me her skin. She said, "Look, Dad, my skin looks like a prune. Do I have to go down and get baptized with you anymore?" And, I mean, it was just anything we could do to try to, you know, find the solution to the problem. I had some problem. I didn't know what it was. People never really told me, you know, "You're an alcoholic." They said, "You're a liar. You're a thief. You're no good. You're crazy." See? And they treated me for each one of those things. They never did treat me for, you know, any drinking or anything like that. I went to the National Council of Alcoholism one time, took a bus all the way over there, went inside, and they said, "Yeah, we'll give you antabuse and antabuse." And some guy drank on antabuse, and he's flopping around. I was like, "Nah, maybe sick, but I'm not crazy. I'm not going to do that. I knew I was going to drink again. Why would I want to take something that's going to make me act like that?" The cops would come to our house all the time, and it was always a big battle. And I found myself standing in front of a judge, and the judge was talking about me, and he had the right guy. And I didn't know what was going to happen. I knew that it was really, I was in trouble now. I had a court case in San Bernardino County, one in Riverside County, in San Diego County, L.A. County, Orange County, whatever county. And I had lawyers trying to juggle all this stuff, and it was just insane. And through a series of events, why somebody, you know, had left an AA pamphlet laying out on the bench when I was chained to these other groups, and I was the last guy to go in, and the judge said 3 to 5, bam, and I held that pamphlet up. I didn't know what it was. You know, it's like alcoholic will reach into their bag of, "What about this?" whatever it was, yeah. And it turned out that it was the judge was in AA. I didn't know that. And just a minute. Well, he took me in the back and he offered me some AA. I didn't know what AA was. I've been doing B&B myself. Found out what 3 to 5 was. So we're going to try something here. We'll do something. We'll set you up with these people, and we'll see how it works out. And so they, did the deal and took me home, brought me off, and set me up with an AA meeting. I'd been in a fight, and a guy hit me upside the head with a crescent wrench, almost tore my ear off. So I had this big blood-soaked, bandage on my head with a big ear muff all blood-soaked. Had hair down on my butt, hair down on my navel, no underwear, no socks, no shoes, no sleeves in my shirt. Weighed about 170 pounds, traveling light. No identification, nothing. You take me home and drop me off. And my wife had gone to see a new lawyer. The lawyer, told her maybe I was an alcoholic. Had a new deal. She come running in the door and said, I think you're an alcoholic. And I let her think it was her idea. I didn't tell her I was supposed to go to this AA meeting. So about 8 o'clock, why'd she come in with a knife? And aren't you supposed to go to AA? Yeah. Peeled me off the couch. I got up. I'll give you this scenario. This is alcoholic as I can be. My house was painted 4 different colors because I lost interest easy. I had real good intentions, but sometimes I got paint that just wasn't enough to paint but one side of the house. It wasn't real standout-ish, but then I had a Corvair and an Edsel parked in the front yard, motorcycle stuck in the front of the house. The doors on the house were not on hinges. You just set them over, like that. That's cool. Not that the rest of the neighborhood didn't look good, but it wasn't that bad. You could drive by my house and you knew. There was a big number painted, my house number was painted on the roof so that helicopters could. So she picked me up and scooped me up. My family wagon was a Pinto, kind of a baby poop brown Pinto. No reverse, went down the road sideways, had a hole in the muffler. And my kid looked like a wounded animal. My wife had one of those Leaning Tower pizza 10.5 spray net things in it because the window on the driver's side, that was her work car, of course. And she had to work. Somebody had to work. And the window was half down or half up. The hair always went out the window. The inside of the car, the dog had licked the windows and the dog hair all over the windows and ice cream and cat hair. And we throw the cat in, the dog in, kid in. And I get in the passenger seat. And we headed for the first AA meeting I ever went to. We pulled up in front of this church, had a big AA sign out in front of the church, and I remember looking in there. Well, I've sunk to the bottom now. I'm going to tell you, that's low bottom snobbery, baby. I don't care where you come from. When you're coming out of a place like that and you think, well, if they see me in here, I'm done. She stuck that knife in me and said, what time is the meeting over? I said, I think it's over at 10. She said, I'm going to tell you something, mate. If your ass comes out of that door before 10, I'm going to gut you. You can keep me in a meeting. You got a crazy woman circling the perimeter of the 12-inch butcher knife. That may be sick, but I ain't stupid, babe. I'm going to stay in there. And I went to one meeting a week, and I didn't drink or use nothing for about 4 weeks. I said, dry as a fire hazard. I'm dying, and I built a little crust, and she let me go by myself, and I went by over there and resigned. Some old guy said, I'm not coming back here anymore. And some old guy said, you must be going to B&B. I said, what's B&B? They said, I don't know, but where you're going ain't AA. And they weren't kidding. I got drunk, and my life changed. It never gets better. It always gets worse. And I started drinking and going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Sometimes I would go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous sober and get up a coffee break and go get drunk and come back and sit in the meeting. Sometimes I would go to a meeting drunk, and I would drink coffee and sober up in a meeting. One time I was in a blackout, and I came out of a blackout in an AA meeting. Oh! That scared the heck out of me. I didn't know who brought me. I was just going to Alcoholics Anonymous to change the conditions in my life. I wasn't going to Alcoholics Anonymous to change my life. I was just on the verge of solving my problem. If you're just on the verge of solving your problem, you don't really, really, really have a problem, do you? Huh? And I did that for about 6 years. And I'd go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'd hear all the answers. The answers were all there. And I would hear the answers, and I'd go home, and I'd tell her, now we're not going to fight anymore. And she'd take one step closer, and I'd say, I'm not going to fight with you anymore. And she'd take one step closer, and I'd say, I'm not fighting anymore. I heard that in AA. She'd take one step closer, and I said, if you don't get out of my face, I'm going to hit you. She'd take one step closer. Bam! I hit her, and the fight would be on. I'd be drunk again. And I'd go back to AA, and I'd go in an AA meeting. I hear him talk about money and taking care of money and managing your money and all that kind of stuff. And I'd go home, and I'd say, I'm going to work the deal out with the money. I'm the kind of guy who puts $100 in 8 different banks and writes $8,000 worth of checks. You know, she went to jail for my checks, you know. And she said, I need money. And I said, we'll work it out. And she said, no, I need money. I said, I'll give you a check. Boom, the fight's on. So then I'm down to the liquor store writing another hot check. I'm drunk again, and I go back to Alcoholics Anonymous. I honk and sniff on the girls, and I'm sighting up some new victim, and I go home, and I said, get in the bedroom, I'm horny. You haven't made love to me in years, you drunk, you stink, you rape me on a regular basis. And I said, well, it seemed to me like you enjoyed it a little bit, you know, whatever. Then we'd have a big fight over who was whose Lord companion, and then, boom, I'd be gone down on Anaheim Street in Long Beach, drunk again, and come back to Alcoholics Anonymous, see. Because I was going home to a drunk house. I was going home where there was no recovery. I could go to Alcoholics Anonymous, but I walked right back into that same old environment. The same me will always drink again. And I'm the kind of an alcoholic, I'm a type 4 alcoholic, and I cannot stay sober in an environment where I drank. I know that today because for the 4 to 6 years I was in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous, 4 to 6 years I violated all the marriage vows, for 4 to 6 years that I had violence in my life, wrote hot checks, defied God. I was drunk. In that whole period of time, when I finally came back to Alcoholics Anonymous, there was only one thing I remember. There's one old guy said, we won't guarantee you after tonight you've had your last drink, but we'll guarantee you that after tonight you'll never enjoy another one. I remember him. I went drunk back to the parking lot and tried to run over him. I was on the wrong night. But there's nothing worse than having a head full of AA and a belly full of booze. And it just got worse, and then it got worse. And I'd stand in my kitchen, take a drink off a bottle of vodka, and look down the hallway, and 9-year-old girl stands at the end of the hallway. She's got her chin on her chest and her hair's in her face, and she's looking at me standing down there. And I turn back around and take another drink, not because I was ashamed of the way we lived or the way we acted. I'd gone way past shame. Heck, you can go way past shame. There's a dark side you can live in that has no feelings, nothing. I'd turn back around and she'd be gone. All she wanted to know is which direction I was going, so she'd go the other way. I know what it's like to stand in my bathroom and I'm putting that stuff in me. And I'm looking in the mirror and I'm tied off doing all those things and a little 10-year-old girl's looking through the hole in the door in the bathroom where I probably stuck my foot. And just for a second, that long, a moment in time, that little girl's eyes catch my eyes and I get a focus just for a second, a frame. I believe the definition of my kind of alcoholic is a drunk with a conscience. A lot of things come to Alcoholics Anonymous nowadays that has no conscience. But I am the type of an alcoholic that I had a conscience. There was moments in time when I had a conscience of what I was doing. And there'd be a screaming inside of me. Something inside of me that was louder than my head. Louder, but no sound coming out of my voice. There's something screaming. If there's something out there, anything out there, can't you see? I don't want to live this way. I don't know how to turn it off. I don't know how to turn it on. It's not working. And I'd just be standing there looking in that mirror. I look back over there and the little girl's gone. All she wants to know is which direction I'm going so she can go the other way. I know what it's like to crawl out of the back of that house on my hands and my knees, barking, yelling, screaming, because I need a drink. There's something going on inside of me. It's something I call the phenomenon of craving. It's screaming inside of me, I need a drink. I got to have something. And I got no money, and the only money in that house is in my daughter's piggy bank. Big time Charlie like me crawls down the hallway, lip dragging drunk. Gurgling. But the one thing I got in the back of my mind is that little girl's raggedy Ann piggy bank. And I know where it is, and I reach under her bed and pull it out. Bam! Bust that thing. And I tell you the kind of alcoholic I am. I'm separating the pennies, nickels, dimes, and quarters because I'm going to be showing nothing but silver when I go to the liquor store, the connection town. Ain't going to be no copper in there, baby. And when I'm stealing money like that from my daughter, I don't know about you. I get that feeling. Get that feeling that somebody's watching me. And I look over my shoulder and a little 10-year-old girl hiding in the closet watching me steal her money. And being the very best father I could be, I'd give that kid a break. I'd let her shoot up without inflicting any more pain in her life. And we lived like that, not a day or a week or a month. We lived like that for 4 to 6 years, every day. Nobody had a choice. They had no choices because alcoholism gives you no choices. You're not victims. You have no choice. We had no answers. We didn't know there was an answer. We didn't know anything. We tried everything. Shock therapy. I did Zen Buddhism, snorting coke and naked. That didn't work. Went to the crazy factory and all that kind of stuff. There was just no answers, helplessly, hopelessly. And I knew AA wouldn't work. I'd gone to AA. I'd been to AA. I'd been to the National Council of Alcoholism. You know, but I was never in AA. I was never in anything. I never did anything. I just showed up. I was just surfing. I was just trying to get the heat off of my back. I was trying to do something, take care of this stuff. I didn't want to live this way. I love my daughter. I'd wake up in the middle of the night, shoot straight up out of my own bed and see a lady laying there and she's got a black eye and a busted lip. It's the lady I love more than my whole life. I remember she used to say, "You're so selfish and self-centered. If somebody fired a gun at me, would you jump in the way of a bullet? Are you crazy? Why would you ask me something like that?" See? I'm usually the guy firing the bullet. See? I had no idea. What am I supposed to do? What am I supposed to do? And ultimately what happened was that I had one last deal. I bought that house that we lived in for $20,000. I owed $140 on it. Had about four patios that weren't built. Oh, EBCO Finance, Aetna Finance, all those high-interest people, about $60,000, $80,000. And they all wanted their money. It was all due, and I had none. And I had borrowed some stuff and dealing, wheeling, dealing, and all went bad, and some people wanted to kill me. There was two groups of people wanted to kill me. One group didn't have any money, so it was a slingshot and a BB. I wouldn't worry about them. But any of these other guys were taking a lot of on me. And you know what they told me later? That the way you were killing yourself was worse than anything we could think of that we could do to you. And one last deal, I had an opportunity to drive a vehicle that had a lot of cocaine in it up to Los Angeles, from Los Angeles to San Francisco. And I'll share this story with you for one reason only. It's a singleness of purpose. This is Alcoholics Anonymous. And I agreed to haul this cocaine from Los Angeles to San Francisco. I got in the vehicle, I stopped off and got me a quart of whiskey. I got up about Santa Maria, drank a half quart of whiskey, and had an alcoholic thought. I think I'll steal the cocaine. So I drove inland and I stole the cocaine, hid the cocaine, drank the rest of that whiskey, and forgot where I hid it. So that's how I know I'm an alcoholic, not an addict. But I sobered up in a day or so and recognized I had a big problem because I couldn't remember where I put that stuff. So I went over to Taft, California. Does anybody here know where Taft is? Front row and center. Taft. It ain't hell, but you can see it from there. The world's got an asshole. It's Taft. Could be. I don't know. Anyway, they got barracks there. I went over and got a room for $50 a year. Not because I was cheap, because I wasn't going to be there long. And that was in December 1975, and I stayed locked up in there and tried to hide out until sometime in May of 1976. From December of 75 to May of 76, I stayed in there, tried to die, tried to live, tried to escape, tried to whatever, and I couldn't do anything, and I finally, you know, if God don't want you to die, you can't die. And I crawled out of there, and somehow made it back home, showed up at my house, and my wife and daughter left, and I crawled around in there drunk, helplessly. I believe when it says what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like today, there is a very significant thing that seems to be omitted a lot, and certainly by myself because I hate to look at it. But the what happened is a very important part of my life and my sobriety. There was a period of time when I was hopelessly, helplessly out of answers, out of solutions, out of prayers, out of oaths, out of clubs, out of gangs, out of information. And that did not happen over a boom. It wasn't a strike of lightning. It was over a period of time where I had to wander around by myself on the floor, drunk, but yet conscious. And it took some period of time. And after some period of time, I was able to get to the phone. My wife came home to get some clothes for my daughter, and she helped me because I needed to make a call. She wouldn't make the call for me. There was a number of Alcoholics Anonymous there. I called Alcoholics Anonymous. Wheelchair Jack, we were talking about him. He was a Marine fighter pilot that crashed his plane and lost his wheels. Wheelchair Jack was on the phone at the South County Central Office in Orange County. And little Jack Callahan, another Marine pilot that crashed his plane but was able to walk, was doing 12-step work. And Wheelchair Jack called little Jack and said there's a big-time slick over there and he needs help. They'd had 3 days there, nobody would come and 12-step me because people had tried to do it and they couldn't get anybody to do it. And Wheelchair Jack called little Jack and tricked him. At the end of the day, he finished working and he got little Jack Callahan, a little guy just died not long ago. And little Jack showed up at my front door. I got up and was moving around, had a gun, and little Jack came to the front door and knocked, and I stuck that gun in his face. So they'd taken me to Brea Psych and all these things. And he grabbed that gun out of my hand and pushed me backwards. Did something he'd never done before since, and he set me down and he said, "Now, if you want help, I'll help you. If you want to commit suicide, I'll give you your gun back and you can blow your brains out. I'll stay here and watch you." And I started crying. I cried. I had no answer. I cried. A total and complete stranger, a guy that I wouldn't even drink with, is standing there saying, "I'll help you." And I helped me. And I grabbed a hold of him and we started a process. It took about 4.5 hours. Unbeknownst to me, I didn't even know my name, I didn't know my phone number, I didn't know my driver's license, social security number, I had so many aliases I could pose for a family portrait by myself. I was just, had all this stuff, I didn't know who I was, but Jack didn't debate it. He told my wife, "Get in the car," told my daughter, "Lock the door, whatever, both, put stuff in front of the door, we'll be back." And it took 4.5 hours through a series of events. There was a brand new detox down in Orange, California that was started by Dr. Zuschka, a non-alcoholic doctor who started the program for the Navy and did a lot of stuff, very interested in alcoholism and treating people, and Dr. Paul Olliger. Dr. Paul Olliger and Dr. Zuschka started this St. Joseph's Hospital program down there. It was a 30 to 60 day program, and because no one else would take me, little Jack took me over to this place and they got me through the emergency room and got me in there. I didn't know who I was, what I was, where I was going, and I just totally believed a total and complete stranger. And the guy said he'd help me, and he pushed me in that door and he said, "Stay." And I did. That's what happened. I got so sweetly reasonable that a total and complete stranger said, "Stay." And you know what they did? They detoxed me. Something that had never happened. They totally detoxed me. Nothing. How about some hard candy and Valium? Anything. No, man. Detox. They didn't treat me for lying, cheating, or any of those things. They didn't shove the steps at me or give me a big book. Detox. Lock me up. Detox. Eat a banana. You need potassium. I'd want to say something. They'd stick a banana in my mouth. Shut up. You want to say something? Put a banana in your ear. They were not nice to me. Shut up. You don't know anything. Your life's in the toilet, dude. And I just shuffle around in there. And 11 days without anything, I kicked again. I went through a whole nother, whatever I was kicking is 11 days. I don't ever, ever want to do that again. It is so vivid tonight that I know I never want to do that again. No matter what has happened to me in my sobriety, I can remember that detoxification period. It's so vivid in my mind standing here right now that nothing has ever been so bad that I think about drinking, but right behind that I think about detoxing. Guy asked me one time, what is it that keeps you sober when things, the chips are down and you think about drinking? Detoxing. See? And I stayed in there. Had to get a sponsor. And this guy came over there and he said, "I'm your sponsor." I said, "I don't like you. I hate you." And he said, "That's fine. I hate you. So, it's not necessary to like me." I said, "Well, what's a sponsor? A friend?" He said, "No, if you want a friend, get a dog." And my dog hates me. And so pretty soon he came and got me. He had an old box van with a bunch of milk crates, plastic milk crates in the back. Get on a crate, hold on. Take off, and he drives up in front of my house, a bunch of other hamburgers in the back of this old van, you know, and he said, I'll be back to get you tonight and take you to a meeting. And I went up the front door, knocked on the door. My wife came to the door. I said, I got to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous every day for the rest of my life. What are you going to do? Well, I've gone to Al-Anon. The kid's gone to Al-Anon. The dog's gone to Al-Dog. The cat's gone to Al-Cat. What are you going to do? And they told me not to say anything to her, so I went in, sat down, shut up. Pretty soon, here they come, got me. I grabbed my old crate. Away they take off. Whoa! And we slide to the back of that old van and fall on top of each other. And then I kill a man with my bare hand. And hit the brakes, and I slid up the front between the captain's chairs. Two old-timers in the captain's chairs. And I'd kill the guy for less than this. He'd take off. I'd slide to the back. Another idiot would fall on top of me. I would have choked him to death, but I was crying. I didn't want anybody to see me cry. I was crying so much when I did, I'd bite holes in my lips to keep from, you know. That guy said, crying's like taking a shower from the inside out. Well, that's nice. Cry. I had no clue. I didn't know what to do. Hey, sit. Shut up. You don't know anything. Say you're an alcoholic and then your name. State your disease and then your name. Say your sobriety date so we'll know what it is. And they taught me that. Because I was such, for 4 to 6 years I was in and out and never had a sobriety date. And this is it, baby. If you don't know it, you're gonna probably don't have one. So say it. And burn that into your mind. That's first and foremost. And I'd go to meetings and I was just nuts. I didn't know what to do. And they got, trimmed my hair up and trimmed my beard up and got me some clothes, took me down to the Salvation Army and got me one of those cool suits. Made me secretary of a meeting. And I stand there in the meeting, you know, looking around and I said, give a cake. Alright. Somebody, I hold a cake, somebody lights it, and they come up and take a cake and they said, now hug them. I don't want to hug them. I eat them. Hug them. Alright. I'd hug them and I had that tingling sensation and question my sexuality there for a minute. I didn't have a clue what was going on. I didn't know what was going on. I didn't know what to do. I didn't have any emotions other than fear. Fear had been my partner all my life. I'm scared to death. I'd been a very violent person, and that all had to stop in order for me to take over, so all that fear went inside. I stuffed it. It was down inside. And it was like my wife said, you're not going to wuss out on me, are you? And he totally released me. I didn't have a clue what to do. I'd go home. I sat at home and somebody said, you need to get a job. You know, it's strange. They used to say that when you were new in AA. Get a job with a boss. Ah, I don't like that. Those people wanted their cocaine back at 52 days sober. I was sitting in a meeting. I said, I don't remember where it is. I didn't ask any newcomers or my sponsor to go with me. I went out, got a phone, called them, and I went and got their stuff and gave their stuff back. And they said, don't call us, we'll call you. I say that for, there's a part in this book, this beautiful book right here, that says, our enemies will welcome us. Be real careful with that. Look up the definition of an enemy before you let them welcome you. At any rate, I gave their stuff back because that belonged to them, not me, and I went back to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had people call me up and wanted to, my sponsor, I was sitting next to my sponsor whining, you know, I mean, I had things, amends, I had immediate amends. I wasn't sure what step I was on, but I had immediate amends. And I sat next to him whining, and he said, over to Whittier to that guy that's going to kill you and tell him you're in AA and you'll make it okay. I said, wait a minute, say that again, that don't even make sense. Go over to Whittier to that guy that's going to kill you and tell him you're in AA and you'll make it okay. I go over and get my old truck, I had an old truck that went down the road sideways, and I went over, knocked on the guy's door, the guy comes to the door, I'm in the bed, I'll make it okay. Bam, I run back to the truck, jump in it, Paul Cheeks back for the Anaheim Milano Club, go in there, said, he said, I thought I told you to go to Whittier. I said, I did. I said, you did? Yeah, I did. He didn't kill you? No. I'll be damned. Then I got it. They send you out to try this stuff, and if it works, they'll do it. I know how this deal works, baby. I'm getting it down now. Had to trade my old truck in, get me a big AA car. Got a big Mark IV Lincoln. Had 104,000 miles on that, baby. Had a hood longer than a horse dream out there, baby. I mean, I got me my AA suit on, my AA tie on, my AA stuff. I was confused. I didn't know if I was Frank or Ernest. Saturdays were bad. I'd wake up in the morning and I'd run in trying to figure out who I was. I'd look in the mirror. Who am I? Where am I going? I like those question and answer meetings where you can write, the question is, who am I and where am I going? My sponsor would pull that out and say, you're an alcoholic and you're going to a meeting. I think, well, I'm from Texas. I'm a cowboy. I put my Levi's on, put my boots on. Get out of the outfit on and look in the mirror. I go out. My wife would right over there and call up her Al-Anon sponsor. I kiss her goodbye and head out. Go get my old pickup. Head for a meeting. I get about a couple blocks down the road and I think, nah, I'm not a cowboy today. I turn around and I go back home and I park my pickup in front. Go in. She'd be talking to her sponsor. I'd go in there and say, I'm a biker today. I'd go in there and get my letters on, my bandana on, and I'd get in front of the mirror and do a couple rip-ups. I'm going to drive my Harley right down there and drive it right through the meeting hall. I'd go out and kiss her goodbye and go get my Harley and fire it up and head down the street, get about a block down the street, hit a light, you know. I'm looking at myself in the mirror. I'm like, no, I'm kind of a pansy today. I turn around. I go back home, park it in there. I go in there and I think, I'm a smart ass today. Get my three-piece suit on and everything up. Get the dictionary out. Look up some of them $75 words. Can you wear that clothes? You got to have them $75 words. I know that. Okay. Recite some of them $75 words in the mirror. I go out and kiss her goodbye. Get my big leg and hip for the meeting. I forget them words. You can't go to a meeting dressed like that. You don't know them big words. Especially if you're like me. All them brainy people borrow you, you know. I turn my leg around. Go back home. Park it out front. Go ahead and take off my clothes. Put on my sweats and run out, jog out, and kiss her goodbye and jog to the meeting. That's why newcomers are tired when they get to a meeting. They've had about four or five identity crises. My wife's sponsor said, how many people live in that house? So I just she said, My wife said, well, he's got it down to four. I did. I didn't really know. I didn't know what's like. Crazy. I wanted to drink and use all the time. I asked the guy, I want to drink and use all the time. He said, you should. You're an alcoholic. This is not familiar for you. Very unfamiliar. I didn't know what to do. And I just followed him around. And I was standing in a meeting one day, and all of a sudden, this guy standing next to me, the weirdest looking guy you ever seen. He ain't short enough to be a midget, tall enough to be a man. Weird guy. Had hair sticking out everywhere. Had a welder's cap pulled down over one ear. Had a pair of shorts on and painted his feet flat with shoe polish, so it looked like you had socks on. I said, you do your shorts that way too? What do you want? He said, will you be my sponsor? I said, oh, man, I must have really made God mad. You know, I don't know. I go over to my sponsor. I see that guy. He said, yeah. I said, he just asked me to be his sponsor. My sponsor said, I know. I sent him over there. And you go over there and tell him you'll do exactly what he says. Now, that don't make sense to me today, but you don't argue with your sponsor. They go crazy and the little vein in their forehead pulsates. And they embarrass themselves and you have to make amends and all that stuff. And so I went back over to this guy and said, my sponsor says I got to take you home and get you. I got to be your sponsor. And he said, yeah, I'm good. So I grab my arm and going over out the door and we get over there. Two guys. I'm 3 years sober. I'm stark raving crazy. I've washed all the cups. I've set up all the meetings. I've tore down all the meetings. I've cleaned all the bathrooms. I've read the book. I've done the steps. Did the traditions. And I'm just like sober. It's like I sit in the back of the room with sober tattooed to my forehead. This is it. This is as good as it's going to be. My wife sponsor said, what if this is as good as it's ever going to be? My wife said, better than it was. I'll take it. Anyway, I'm with this guy. I said, come on. We get by the door, and he tells these guys, that's my new sponsor. I said, don't tell people I'm his sponsor, idiot. I'd seen him in the meeting the night before. He was a trader. They asked for a trader report, and he stood up and said, I stole all the money, and I'm not going to pay it back. And I got in my car and he said, how about this? And he started telling me some sick stuff. You know that stuff? Sick stuff. He said, how about that? Did you ever do anything like that? I told him a couple of things. He said, man, you're sick. We need to go to a meeting. I take him home, drop him off, go back and get him. It looked like he just stood inside the door. I said, why don't you comb your hair? He said, I did. You did? Really? Oh, but yeah. Yeah. How about this? He told me some sick, sick stuff. A couple of things he told me I had to like. I mean, you can't let them one up you. No. I picked him up the next day and he said, I know you lied to me. And I said, how do you know that? He said, because it's physically impossible to do what you said to do. I tried it. Well, it's up to God. I took him to hear Chuck Chamber and we sat on the front row and Chuck took us through the steps and God and the carpenter and the big book and we went out in the car and he said, we need a miracle, dude. So what do you mean? He said, we need a miracle. We need a miracle like a burning bush or a parting of the water or something. I said, I had a .45 automatic in my glove box. I reached over and got it out, run around the chamber, put it upside his head. I said, I'll tell you what, I'll count to 10, you pray. If I don't have a burning resentment here that I decide to pop a cap on your ass, you've just done step 3. Everything was doing pretty good, so I put it back in the glove box. He jumped right out of my car, went in that meet where my sponsor was and showed him that ring on the side of his head where I put the barrel of that gun. Lay it on me. Say it. What's loyalty here, dude? I just took you through the first 3 steps and you didn't even realize it and you're ratting me off. My sponsor said, yeah, I know. Ain't he spiritual? Yeah. Hey, we're all still sober. If you don't believe me, check with some of them bent fenders back there in the bag, baby. I thank whoever gave me that basket. There's a 10-in-1 tool in there. We're going to need that to get those bikes out of the parking lot tomorrow when we leave. I sure want to thank you for that one. And we'll blow bubbles on the way home. A little side thing. I forgot to thank whoever. See, Al-Anon gave me that basket with stuff in it that I've never seen before. I can't wait to take that home and try it on Grandma. I got some good stuff, huh? From Al-Anon. You betcha. Anyway, I wouldn't have said that if Mickey hadn't been sitting right there. I seen Mickey and my mind just went poised. A guy showed up at my front door and he had a big book of paper stuck in it and he came in my house and wanted to work the steps and all that stuff, but I moved on. I had my clothes off and a gi on, sitting cross-legged naked in the front floor, humming. That's the 14th or 14th and a half step. And so we need to work the steps. And I know I'm powerless because you're in here and my life's unmanageable because you're going to stay and you're crazy and I'm crazy. We've got to be on step 3. And so you're not going to get that gun out, are you? No. We're going to go in the kitchen, get on our knees and do the 3rd step prayer together. And he said, you going to put some pants on? Yeah, went and put some pants on, came back, we got on our knees, he crawled up underneath my arm, and I had that tingling sensation, questioning my sexuality again. The cat walked by and looked at us weird. Got up, he threw a bunch of blank paper in front of me and said, I have to do my 4th step, and I said, you got to have that done when you get here. And he said, I can't write, you write, I talk. He started talking, and I started writing. And then he said, did you ever do anything like that? And I remember we asked God in here, he can't read. I think I'll just put some of my stuff in here. You know, what the heck? Hey, when God sends a dumpster, don't wait for the garbage barge. Put it in the dumpster. We put that in there and we burnt that one and he kissed me on the cheek and away he went and said, I love you. And it went from the head to the heart. That's the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous. Don't look for something that isn't here. That is the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous from that day to this. I needed nothing else. Look for nothing else. I haven't had no sabbaticals, no time off for good behavior. I've stayed right in the trench, right with my home group, right with sponsorship, and right with God. And if talking about God offends you, I'm real sorry. But I'd a whole lot rather offend you than I would God. I've offended God way too long. It isn't even a debatable issue. You betcha. I went to one of the meetings one time, they had the back of the book opened up for a spiritual experience, and I went in and I was crazy. And I said, when am I going to have mine? They said, you are one, you idiot. Go look in the mirror. And I was sober, just to be sober. I couldn't distinguish the difference between fear and joy till I was 8 years sober, because it was like when one good thing happened, bam, something bad happened. My daughter came home, she went to LT, and they taught her to look beyond where other people feared to go, and she made a dream to be a model, and she came home one day and said, Dad, I want to go to the Orient and model. I had this contract here. I want you to sign it so I can go to the Orient Model. She was like 15. And I said, oh man, if I had this contract and I had you and I wasn't your father, you'd be put out in no time. And so she said, okay, jerked it out of my hand. Her mother went and got in the car and they drove around the corner and signed my name and came back the way she went. There was nothing I could do about it. She came back 6 months later, had money, had a new portfolio, had a great experience, and nothing bad happened to her. I said, really? She said, yeah. No, there is no spot where God is not. Okay. Because the joy, I couldn't have the joy for somebody else because everything in my life had been this miserable, fearful experience. Because inhibiting fears, I cheated myself out of so many things because of inhibiting fears. I didn't try things. I was satisfied with less. I never put forth any effort. And I'm so grateful for sponsorship, people that got behind me that would not let me rest on my laurels. You need a trash bag up there? They would not let me rest on my laurels. They pushed me. They pushed me. Every good thing in my life is preceded by a wall of fear. Every good thing in my life has been preceded by a wall of fear. I have to walk through the walls of fear to get on the other side, to have the faith, to have the experience, to have the hope to enjoy life. My sobriety is not a veil of tears. It's not a series of misfortunes and mistakes. My sobriety is sober since May 11th, 1976, to this moment right now. And I'm not going to settle for anything else in this moment right now. I want it all. I want the whole thing. I want the whole enchilada. I want to line up for the good stuff. I don't want to line up for the bad stuff. I did that before I got here. Had all those bad experiences before I got here. I tried all those things before I got here. Nothing worked. The only thing that's worked for me for 29 years has been Alcoholics Anonymous. Basic form. I've needed nothing else. I've looked for nothing else. I've asked for nothing else. And it's been given to me. Half measures avail you nothing. What you do speaks so loud I cannot hear a word you say. Stand in your own shadow. Be who you are. You're given an opportunity to walk out there on that street and hold your head up. You don't have to look down anymore. Look them in the eye. Look them in the eye. I don't like to make amends. I don't like the pain. But I don't have to live in it anymore. I've had to walk through every rotten, dirty thing I ever did. Every rotten, dirty thing I ever did other than die. I've had to walk through to see how you felt when it happened to you. It had to happen to me sober so I could make my 8-step list. Now that's a real, if you're new, don't think about that too much. But you can live through it. Not only can you live through it, you can get through it, and if it don't kill you, it makes you stronger. Pow! You betcha. That's what this is about. Having spiritual muscle. So I can walk around with some dignity. I remember I went through a thing at 10 years sober. I mean, it was a butt kicker sober. So the ego got big, and I was something, and I was a big deal, and I was chairman of the convention, and I was the head sick, and had committees, and speaking, and money, and slaves, and sitting in the meeting, and I sponsored everybody in the meeting, and I counted everybody in there, and I sponsored them all, and I was hanging around with people that fed that ego, and there was a knock on my door, and it was the FBI. I didn't wake up one morning and say, hey, I think I'll just give up a life of crime today. I'd been involved in organized crime for 20 years. 10 years into sobriety. It wasn't a way of life. It was a lifestyle. Just because I went to AA, I didn't bring it into AA or take it. It was another life. Totally and completely. I'm not talking about the, well, I think I'll resign this church. You go, that, I was involved deep enough that you don't quit. You don't just decide not to. You've gone past that. It's a lifestyle. I didn't stop it and start it over again. I never stopped it. And in 10 years sober, it became painfully apparent to me that it is one thing to tell a lie, but it is another thing to live a lie. And I can't live a lie and stay sober, baby. There ain't no way that a real alcoholic can live a lie and stay sober. You betcha. And I'd rather lie to you than tell the truth any day. But living a lie, it's impossible to stay sober. And my life stopped. And 10 years sober, I sit in participation meetings. And there's guys sitting at them tables back there that 18, 19 years sober. They were there, newcomers. And I sit in those meetings. Thank God for those participation meetings. They'd all been speaker meetings. I'd have probably committed suicide. But I was in participation meetings, 10 years sober, saying my ass is falling off. And I'm going to tell you the greatest fact of all. And I'm sure there's people sitting here tonight that have years of sobriety that their ass is falling off. And there's people in this room that will say, you deserve it, slick. Been running around here shooting your mouth off and the shit's coming down now, baby. And you're going to get what you need to grow. Well, good. God bless you. But I'm going to tell you something. There's people sitting in here tonight that will come out and get you by the hand and they'll say, come with me. I've been there. And 10 years of sobriety is worth saving just as much as 10 days. You bet your butt. You better know that. 10 years of sobriety, 20 years of sobriety, time is no guarantee that you're not going to have those bad days. It's not something to get you by the throat and twist your head off. I was reduced to that point that says absolutely. Dr. Tebow says in his little lecture there that the alcoholic ego must be smashed in order to have continuous sobriety. And it will be smashed again and again and again. And I never left AA. I didn't double up on my meetings because I couldn't double up. I was already going to them. Didn't double up on anything. I kept doing what had got me to 10. And I got next to old timers. Old timers. I'm talking about old timers. Like John here. Come go with me. I've been through some crap. We can get through it. And they walked me through it. I went into the unemployment office and filed out unemployment, and the little lady came back a couple of days and said, you can't draw unemployment because you lied on your application. I'm 10 years sober. And I lied. A little gray-headed lady, you can't draw unemployment because you lied on your application. You're a liar. I walked out. I mean, I'm driving a Mercedes that the payment is 3 times my unemployment check. I got no money, but I went down there because somebody told me, you need to go file for unemployment. And I lied and I couldn't get it. And I remember Don Peelick. Jungle Don was my sponsor back then. Jungle Don was sitting outside. We go get in that Mercedes and Jungle Don said, okay, the smoke in here. I said, yeah. He fires up, rolls the window down, said, nice wood. I said, Don, I can't draw unemployment. Yeah, I know. I said, if you knew, why'd you make me go do that thing? He said, so you learned something. I said, what'd you learn? I said, that little old lady said, I'm a liar. I said, then you learned something. Well, what am I going to do? I said, get a job. How profound. John tells me, when you're going through hell, don't stop. Don't you love those kind of things? I love those kind of things. Keep trucking, baby. Keep trucking. Don't look back. It don't make any difference if it's gaining on you. Keep going. And I went to those meetings and I told people, and I got all these newcomers and all the other people that had asked me to be their sponsor because I was flashing dough and head yo, they're gone. Boom, they abandoned ship like rats. Pow, they're gone, baby. I had one newcomer. Oh, ye of little faith. I put the fertilizer on him and next thing you know, I got a whole crew going again. And they're buying the ice cream and I'm riding their old Plymouth. You know? And they slammed the dunk on me over there at the federal building and I had to stand in there and I went over there to be interrogated by a federal grand jury. And I asked Jungle Don, I said, I never have snitched on nobody, dude. He said, you don't have to snitch on anybody today either. He said, don't answer the questions that aren't asked. He said, all your life you've ratted everybody off. Because you had to blame them or use them to justify your own actions. Don't answer the questions that aren't asked. And I went in there and I got through the deal. The last thing old Don said when I walked in that door, he said, don't let them rob you of your dignity. And I had stood the test. And it wasn't a big enough deal to get anything. I got off the deal, had to change some things, had to go meet with some people and say, I'm done, I'm out. And he said, you can't do that. And I said, I can because if I don't, I'm going to be drunk. If I'm drunk, nobody's safe. And I share this with you for one reason. It's over. It's done. but it was handled with the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. I did not come to AA and quit this lifestyle. I never stopped. I stopped drinking and using, but I never quit the lifestyle. I was so crazy. I thought if I quit it and started up again and quit it and started up again, I'm eventually going to drink. But I never stopped that part of my life. And at 10, 11 years sober, I was able to walk out of that and use the principles of this program and the loyalty. And today, in that element, in that criminal element, I'm regarded very highly with respect among those people. Because I snitched on no one, nor did I step on anybody's back. But I walked through there with dignity and answered my questions and stood the test for my responsibility. And because of that, I got through the deal, went and got a job, worked and stayed sober, and became a member of Alcoholics Anonymous in good standing and only an alcoholic. My wife said one time, "Why don't you just be an alcoholic?" Out of the mouth of Al-Anon. I just love it. They're just so simple. Why don't you just be an alcoholic? It's so easy. So easy for you. Why don't you just be an alcoholic? And I just tried to be an alcoholic. Tried to be a sober alcoholic. I get up in the middle of the meeting and run to the football field and stand at the end of the football field when my daughter came down there at halftime, lean up against the fence like all the other lames. And when my daughter came down there, she, "Hi, Dad. Hi, Mom." Then she's gone. And I could go running back into my meeting and sit down. "Oh, okay." Stand next to my daughter when she married this jackass from Italy. "Don't marry the image of your father." She went all the way to Milan, Italy, the model, and married a guy just like me, only don't drink. He's obsessed with work, isn't that great? And money. Since she married him, she's never had to wire home for money. I love him. He's a cool dude. They're the same age. He treats her good. She married into an old Italian family, and they treat her like she's one of their... I do not meddle in their life. I do not have any... I've been there. I've introduced myself so they know what I look like, what have you. But I do not meddle in their life. They have a very traditional, very old, traditional, very, very wealthy family. They do not need anything I have. I don't need to live in one of their guest houses. I don't need a loan. I just simply am dad. And my wife's been there when our granddaughter was born, she was there, and she was grandma. She fulfilled that commitment. And the little girl got to come home. She always come home. It makes a nice story. I'll tell you about me. I'll tell you about these marks on my arm. La mia famiglia. Tell you about where I come from, what I had to do to live there. And I tell you what happened one day. My daughter's on an airplane and flew all the way from Milan, Italy, and landed in Los Angeles with an 18-month-old little girl. And I'm standing down at that international airport, and my grandma's sitting next to me. I don't know how to act in there. I'm just like any other jackass. I'm jackassing around looking at all the people from all over the world. So I was smart enough to get over behind them balloons and flowers. They got a little stand there with all the balloons and flowers, huh? I wasn't going to buy nothing, but I'm going to stand by it. Person, our daughter came up that walkway, and she had that little 18-month baby girl in her arms. And that little girl saw those balloons and all those things she'd never seen me before in my life. Had a short sleeve shirt on. I was just me. My daughter walked over to me and she handed me that little girl. And that little girl's eyes were sparkling and shining. She was giggling. And I looked and my daughter standing in front of me and my wife standing there and they're watching me. And I danced around like an old fool and I danced. I didn't care who saw me. And that little girl laughed and cooed. And she wasn't afraid of me. She wasn't afraid of me. She knew not the way I treated her mother. her grandma. She wasn't afraid of me because I was gentle and kind. My daughter can trust us because she can call the same phone number and get grandma and grandpa. She tells her mother, I hope I have the same relationship with my daughter that I have with you, Mom. Because she knows, because of the program of AA and Al-Anon, she knows where to find her mother and dad. She has examples in front of her that she can trust. Because of family recovery. And I do believe this. If I keep doing what I'm doing here tonight, there could be 10 or 15 more years go by, and that little girl has no reason whatsoever to fear me. God bless, and thank you.